Okay, good morning, everybody. Please be seated. We'll go ahead and call our next case, which is case number 63474, PM Roman numeral 2 versus District Court, and together with the real parties in interest. Okay, Mr. Carlson, you represent the petitioner, and Mr. Persignano, I understand you're going to handle the whole argument for the respondents. Is that correct? Okay, very well. Mr. Carlson, you may proceed.
I'd like to reserve 4 minutes.
You do so.
Chief Justice Givens, members of the court, may please the court. We present you today as the first impression issue for the court to determine about class action tolling based upon the filing of a class action lawsuit, which in this particular case never sought class action certification. That class action allegation was withdrawn almost 2 years after the initial filing of the complaint. And during that time period, the plaintiffs were able to convince the trial court that the tolling period for unnamed class members, the statute of repose for unnamed class members had been tolled. And in some cases, I invite the court to consider page 13 of our opening brief. For example, the Woods, who have a home 5401 Bridge Hampton, obtained 813 days of tolling as a result of the plaintiffs filing a complaint on 11-18-09, not serving it, amending it on March 17th of 10, waiting 120 days to serve that until 7-15-10, and then not filing their Chapter 40 notices in a timely fashion, which resulted in the trial court staying the action, so eventually the entire matter was stayed and, according to the plaintiff's analysis, told for 813 days, which if my math is correct, is 2 years and 84 days beyond the 10-year statute of repose. We think that this is not a result of the legislature intent. We think this is not a result that is consonant with the legislative intent. We believe that this court should establish that the tolling that the plaintiffs argued in the lower court is not applicable to class action lawsuits for construction defect on the statute of repose. And the reason for that is, and I think a very nice analysis was provided by the Arizona Supreme Court in the case of Albano versus Shea Holmes. Our law firm was amicus in that case. We're relatively familiar with it. The court, I'm sure, has had an opportunity to look at it. But basically, the Arizona Supreme Court went over the federal cases, went over their statutory scheme. It was presented with basically the same issue, which is should a statute of repose be tolled through a judicial ruling, which is the statute, the tolling in this case, such that the substantive right of a fine and to potential liability is continued in some cases for a very substantial period of time. As I indicated, 813 days is the longest for Mr. Woods. That court did a very good analysis and is highly congruent to statutory scheme here in Nevada. NRS 11203 provides for the outside limit. The Arizona statute provided for an outside limit. Theirs is 8 years, ours is 10 years. They're limited by their constitution to not expand the rights by judicial fiat. NRS 2.120 subsection 2 has a similar limitation here. The issue that we're presenting to the court, as we believe it's a first impression, is whether the procedural aspects of filing of a motion or filing a complaint with class action allegations should defeat the legislative intent of a final outside limit. And we believe it shouldn't. And the reason for that is fairly simple, is that the legislative intent is that from the day of substantial completion of this home until perhaps 10 years, maybe a little bit longer, depending upon when the final defect occurs, not discovered, as stated in the reply, that is an outside limit and should end the potential for exposure, absent the one limitation that has no limit, which is intentional concealment, fraudulent concealment, intentional misconduct of Woods, pending for the court in another case. I thought our opening brief was rather aggressive in pointing out that we felt that we, our clients, had been taken advantage of because of the failure to serve two successive times and the long period of time and the failure to serve a Chapter 40 notice, thereby resulting in a stay. In the situation we have had to be unlimited tolling that can occur on a statute of repose. Obama talks in some detail about why that is not an appropriate response to a statute of repose, and we believe that this court should adopt that reasoning. The Obama court went into some considerable detail about it and talked about the substantial rights versus the procedural obstacles to filing the lawsuit. What I think we're looking for is to have an outside limit, which I think the legislature granted us, and also for the practical reason that it's very difficult to come up with the information, witnesses, documentation, all those things necessary to defend yourself 12 years after the substantial completion of a home. The plaintiffs have argued to the court that, and I want to invite the court to consider one of the things that, particularly about this case, was that Rule 23 provides, as this court is aware, that you seek as soon as practicable class certification. That is to avoid, I think, on a general basis, this kind of long, drawn-out situation where you have a tolling taking place, equitable in nature, and you have no way to resolve it. We thought, especially in this case, the failure to serve put us in a very awkward position because we didn't have a mechanism even to require that there was a seeking of a certification. And so now we have a situation where if you just take the two periods between where the complaint was filed until it was finally served on us, I think it added up to 238 days. 120 plus 118. 238 days before the complaint was even served on us, where by this filing of a class action litigation, they obtained that much an extension. But a part of the year is added on for unfiled persons. This court has addressed the issue of tolling on a couple of occasions, neither of which went into any detail about analysis, neither of which really addressed the issue of statute of repose. There's some very generalized comments in two cases where there was a statute of limitations is told for purposes of this filing. Another case says that the limitations periods are told. But I don't believe this court has directly addressed the issue about statute of repose. And the trial court can certainly be, one can understand how the trial court may have gone in this direction, but the issue for us, and we asked for this court, is to consider, can a procedural rule, which clearly the tolling is on the filing of a statute, of the filing of a class action lawsuit, override the substantive right inherent in a statute of repose provided to us by the legislature? And I think the court would have to conclude, based upon a reasoning analysis and NRS 2.120 subsection 2, it does not. I don't think it's necessary for us to go into some of the issues that were raised in the reply about the statutory tolling that's inherent in the statute. We're not really arguing about that because it's inherent in the statute, and so we're not saying that that's an equitable tolling or a judicial tolling. Those tollings are provided by the statutory scheme. They're going to operate, obviously, within the statutory scheme. But this is an extra legislative enactment based upon some Supreme Court decisions which adopted the United States Supreme Court decision, which very generally didn't apply to or didn't address statute of repose either. Based upon all that, we believe that this court should look carefully at Obama. The reasoning there is fairly straightforward. Urbano allows or concludes, as we suggested to the court, but I'd like to address really briefly the issue about the Chapter 40 tolling that is thrown in the, pardon me, that is mentioned at the end of the reply from the plaintiffs in this case. Their Chapter 40 notices were filed almost a year after their complaint was filed. So the statutory tolling associated with filing the Chapter 40 notice really wouldn't apply to these cases. So we really want to address the issue of, is there a judicial tolling based merely upon the filing of the complaint? It's an issue that's going to impact many, many lawsuits. We're suing these types of allegations in many lawsuits. And this one would bring to the court's attention mostly because we felt it was a very illustrative of the potential abuse associated with this type of thing. If the court has any questions, I'll be happy to address them.
Questions? Anybody? Okay, thank you, Mr. Carlson. We've got almost 5 minutes. Mr. Corsiano.
Please, the court. I'm David Corsiano. I'm here to represent the real parties in interest. The real parties in interest respectfully request this court affirm the trial court decision, the decision which was in part based on the Dancer decision rendered by this court. I was interested and surprised at the vituperativeness at which the briefs in this case pointed towards us as counsel. And I only make that comment for this reason. Mr. Carlson, Ms. Dorsey, and that firm is one that we all grew up together. We've been practicing against each other and with each other, actually, in one particular instance for 30 years. And we have a deep mutual respect. So I was surprised when I got the brief and it had such pointed and nasty language. That's my interpretation, but in part very vituperative. And my conclusion was, as I know these people real well, I know that they respect me, that really their function was to distract the court. They want to distract the court from the real issue in this case. And the real issue in this case is whether Dancer, the Dancer decision applies and was intended to toll statutes of repose during the pendency of the class claim. Moreover, and as an additional basis, whether the statutory scheme within Chapter 40, which clearly sets forth several different tolling of statutes of limitation repose instances, apply in this case. And it's the real partisan interest position that they do.
Mr. Purcell, let me ask you one procedural question here. This is a kind of red as opposed to a direct appeal. We have a denial of a motion for summary judgment. From your client's perspective, do you think we should even entertain the writ to start with? Is this a question you need answered? Mr. Carlson said it's a first impression issue and asked us to answer the question. Should we entertain it, number one? And then number two, if you say yes, then of course you went to the merits of it, why in support of your position.
Whether you should entertain the writ really isn't my decision, but is your decision, obviously. I would think that this issue is one that would better be entertained at the end of the case. After all, the evidence is in, and particularly with respect to the evidence of the applicability of these claims to the tolling under Chapter 40 and under Dancer. We don't have all of that evidence. And I think issue number two that this court posed in its synopsis was poignant, because it really, while I don't agree that there needs to be a legitimacy analysis to some degree, I think that it points to that there's more information, more data, more facts that need to be before this court before it can make a full decision. Mm-hmm. We believe Dancer, the language in Dancer wasn't, at least in footnote 2, we don't believe that was careless or just dicta. In pointing out the difference under Rule 23, our Rule 23 is an opt-in. meaning that you are in unless you opt out. Excuse me, it's an opt-out. You are in the case as a putative class member unless you opt out. And in the answer, in footnote 2, it was merely trying to tell the litigants that because of the opt-out, you are deemed in, and the statutes of limitation, any limitation period would apply to the claim. Now, it could have said, it could have used other words, but it's at any limitation period. And it wasn't finite. Statutes of repose are a limitation period. Historically, statutes of repose have been referred to as that way. In some jurisdictions, the statute of repose is a statute of limitation. So I don't think those words were used carelessly, and that's how the lower court ruled. But more importantly, or as importantly, is Chapter 40. And Albanos is really instructive on this point. Albanos, the Arizona court, said that if there is some legislative enactment or some legislative pronouncement with respect to the application of tolling, you've got to look at that because it's part of the scheme. And the reason why that's important is because class actions have one really important function, among others. But one of the most important functions is judicial economy, promote judicial economy. So courts are inclined to allow class actions, so long as obviously you meet the requirements, because it does just that, it promotes judicial economy. And our legislature went a great way in devising Chapter 40 to be sure that because it was setting requirements on claimants to do certain things before they could initiate a claim, that their claims, their rights wouldn't lapse. This court has noted in the First Light case the tremendous effort placed on claimants in assembling information to make a claim. So in devising the legislative scheme, what the legislature did is it envisioned two potential situations, and it wanted to address them. 40.695. 40.695 is the section that deals with the tolling of the statute of repose and limitations, and it's very clear that it is intended to toll the statutes of limitation and repose upon the serving of a notice. So that's a situation where the claimant has plenty of time. They have plenty of time to gather all their information and get the notice to the developer so the developer can react to it. That's a different situation than we have in this case. But in any event, the statutes of limitation and repose are tolled for a period of time 30 days after the mediation. And that's for any claim that falls within Chapter 40. And it uses that very specific, didn't say Chapter 40, but it uses that very specific language. So it says, except as otherwise provided, and I'll read it into the record, except as otherwise provided in subsection 2, the statutes of limitation of repose applicable to a claim based on construction defect governed by 40.600 to 695, Chapter 40, inclusive, are told from the time notice of claim is given until 30 days after mediation is concluded or waived in writing pursuant to 40.680. And so there's no doubt that our legislature was concerned about lapsing of rights as the plaintiffs geared up to meet the requirements that the legislature was placing on them.
But doesn't the legislation indicate that there is a concern for the substantive rights by the very nature of the statute of repose?
I think it does. But I think it's also balancing that with the due process rights of the claimant. Because if it didn't provide for tolling, those rights could lapse as the claimant is assembling the information and assembling the expert data to be able to support the claim. So, yes, it recognizes that in part there's a substantive right there, but it balances that with the obligations and duties it places on the plaintiff, on the claimant. And moreover, and I think what really, really is important, this court has recognized in a number of different cases, one of the real policies of Chapter 40 is to promote the equal treatment or the similar treatment of similarly situated homes.
But they, and going back just to, I'm trying to get back to this issue with the procedural aspect as opposed to the substantive aspect as it relates to statute of limitations and statutes of repose and the difference.
I think that the courts in, the court in Albanos looked at that and threw up its hands, much like I did when I read it. I really was confused by it. And it, because it was seemingly making a distinction without a difference, but moreover, as Albanos said, it is a tension between two different, very different policies. And the equitable tolling is a mechanism that the courts use to save a claim as a result of excusable conduct, excusable neglect, or something of that sort. And it was very clear in that. And so it said it makes really no solid reason to distinguish between the two. And that's and in saying that, it said what we're really going to do is look at what the legislative intent is behind these and the scheme in the jurisdiction. I practiced in Arizona. I'm not an Arizona licensed lawyer, but I practiced in there. They had a very, and the court makes mention of this at the tail end of the Albanos decision, they had a savings clause. And that savings provision acts like it's a savings provision in that if you get dismissed, you have 6 months after you dismiss to refile your action, bring it in a different form or whatever. So it saves and it protects the rights. And it used that to say our scheme is not like what other states have, which is precisely the reason why the Ninth Circuit sent it to the Arizona Supreme Court to decide. It says, this is really a states' rights issue. You guys decide it because we don't want to impose a federal will on what is otherwise a state right. Here, we're totally different. Our scheme is very different. We have decided, our legislature has decided, that they will toll statutes of repose.
Well, statute of limitations.
No. In Chapter 40, statutes of repose. 40.695 says that. And that's not the only section. 40.695 says, except as otherwise provided in subsection 2, statutes of limitation or repose applicable to a claim based on constructional defects under Chapter 40.
We also discussed the difficulties with class action certification construction defect context.
And I will address that because it really is an important question. There are circumstances when it is literally physically impossible for a claimant to assemble all the data to be able to serve in those, to then be able to toll the statute. And the legislature foresaw that. They foresaw that. 40.672 subsection, 40.647 subsection 2 deals precisely with that. And it makes sense. Because in those circumstances where claimant comes to a lawyer's office and they have a whole bundle of problems and it involves a whole bunch of houses and the statute runs in 3 days, there's no way that a claim can be put together and proffered to the developer in order to toll. So they said, in those circumstances, we'll do the following. And let me read it in the record if I may. It's subsection 2. So it says, if a claimant commences an action without complying with subsection 1, that's subsection 1 of 40.647, or NRS 40.645, which is the notice provision, the court shall the court shall dismiss without prejudice to require the plaintiff to comply, or if the dismissal, and this is the important part from our position, if the dismissal of the action would prevent the claimant from filing another action because the action would be procedurally barred by the statutes of limitation or the statute of repose, the court shall stay the proceeding. That's what happened here. That's what happened here. Now, our legislature has said, look, in the construction defect framework, we understand the complexity. We understand that claims can't be generated overnight. And rather than have people's rights lapse so that members in a community are treated, similarly situated members in a community are treated in a fair and equal fashion, and the developer has an opportunity to deal with them in a fair and equal fashion, we are going to toll statutes of repose. And that's precisely the legislative scheme. Now, there's one other section that deals with statute of repose in that doesn't really apply, but it's 40.468. 40.468 deals with a master developer. Not an issue here. The point is, yes, sir.
Aren't those statutes that you're referring to statutes that are intended to protect the homeowner so that they can comply with the provisions of Chapter 40?
I would agree.
The issue in this petition is whether there are added days beyond Chapter 40 compliance periods that are needed in order to preserve your client's rights to file their claim. So we're not talking about just the number of days that Chapter 40 compliance occurred in this case. You need more days than that in order to be within the statute of repose as she would be extended, right?
Correct.
So why should we look to Chapter 40, a statute that incorporates statutory protections for the homeowner to meet Chapter 40 requirements, when the issue here is whether or not there's tolling to satisfy class action complaints, especially in this case where, and maybe you can expand on it, I'm sorry for the lengthy question, I apologize, but
I got 2 seconds.
In this case, maybe the chief would be kind enough to give you the time to answer my lengthy question. But if I keep talking, you'll never get to it. But the question here is, particularly in this case, where the class action was withdrawn. So your clients seek to take the benefit of a class action tolling on a case where the basis for that tolling was actually withdrawn.
That's right. And let me see if I can break that down and respond. Chapter 40 and the precepts of Chapter 40 apply to litigation. Mm-hmm. This claim falls squarely within what Chapter 40 envisioned, a lawsuit that's filed without compliance with the notice provisions. And the legislature foresaw that in order to preserve homeowner rights, the statutes of repose would be tolled. That's unmistakable. That's within the fabric of our law. That's unequivocal in our view. So you have that. That has to be dealt with right up front. That's what we did. And we went about doing exactly what we're supposed to do, and that is to gather the information. We gathered it, we served it, and the court did what we had agreed. What we told the court we would agree to do, and that was stated. So everybody's rights were preserved. Now, we're not extending a period beyond what Chapter 40 envisioned. Because while there is tolling when you file a claim outside of litigation, there is also tolling when you have a situation where you cannot provide your notice before the filing of the litigation. And when those circumstances happen, then the court says, the legislature says that the court's obliged to stay it. if the statutes of repose are in jeopardy. Now, there are safeguards. There are safeguards and issues. When we filed this case as a class action, we had a good faith belief that there were conditions within the homes that we looked at and throughout the project that warranted class certification. Now, I'm not here to take the position that every circumstance is class certifiable, but I think there are significant areas that can be certified as alleged in our complaint. Design defects. A slab foundation design is susceptible and can be certified. We've had it in cases where it's not one home, it's not two homes, it's not five homes. Four or five model types within the entire development, the foundation system is inadequately designed, 100%. We have had issues where in this case in particular, corrosion protection of the foundation systems. The soils in this area are high in salts. The chlorides attack ferrous metals. The engineers in this town have recognized for years that you have to protect the ferrous metals, the embedded metals in a concrete slab. And that wasn't done. The problem with this case, what happened in this case that caused us to withdraw, and that shouldn't be used as a penalty. That should be a recognition that instead of requiring us to go through and have a motion that we know is going to lose, be denied, that doesn't make any sense. What we did is, and the problem in this case, back to that, is there are no plans and specs. There are no soils reports. And the other side can say, well, it's because the case is so old. When this case was filed, it was less than 10 years old. This case was preceded by another case in the development. So it was one where if the documents didn't exist, that's not a problem that we envisioned when we filed the case. But in recognition that we didn't have the information to sustain, even though we believed that there was a systemic problem, to sustain class action, we withdrew.
Mr. Purcell, can you wrap this up? You know, we appreciate...
I was trying to respond to the question, and okay. I did, Justice Augustine.
Okay.
I would merely conclude that Albanos is a great decision and says that if there's a legislative scheme in place, that's really important. Chapter 40 is in place and governs both claims inside and outside of litigation, and we're going to govern these. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much as well. Mr. Carlson. If we have questions, we'll give you a little extra time too. We'll see if we have any questions.
Mr. Carlson, if you could, if you would respond to the discussion that was just entered into about the relationship of 4647 sub 2 and 6 and 40 and 645 from your position.
Just like I see, those sections, if they had been complied with, wouldn't be the subject of what we're talking about. Because they, the plaintiffs in this case, filed their first chapter of 40 moves on July 2nd of 10. And I'd like the court to consider it's our exhibit 4. And then they filed their second one on 4-4-11. That was considerably after they filed their complaint. The complaint was filed on 11-18-09. 8 months almost elapsed before they filed the first Chapter 40 notice. If we were talking about Chapter 40 notice and tolling, that would be a completely different issue. But what the plaintiffs are taking advantage of, the people who didn't file Chapter 40 notices are taking advantage of, is the tolling associated with the filing of the class action allegations. And looking at the court synopsis, also, can we really separate construction defect and class action? You're attempting to do?
Yeah,
Henry?
They're kind of intertwined, so to speak, as this case goes forward and then separates if it's proper to be handled as a class action versus consolidated or other form?
Well, in this particular case, the plaintiffs chose not to continue as a class, but I really believe this writ's here because it faces a broader issue, and I would like to address that.
And before you make that point, though, I also have questions about 4647.2b. If you file a complaint that includes class action allegations, the statutes are set out on the answer to the petition on page 21. If you file a complaint alleging that it's appropriate for class certification and you do so before the 10 years expires, and then the 10 years expires, and then somebody says, we want to dismiss the class allegations, and at that time, the Chapter 40 opportunity has expired, you're outside the 10 years, why wouldn't this 2B apply? If dismissal of the action would prevent the claimant from filing another action because the action would be procedurally barred by the statutes of limitations or repose, the court shall stay the proceeding pending compliance with those provisions by the claimant. Now, it may well be that the claimant doesn't want to go do that, but why wouldn't that apply? That's my question.
If the claimant had made a Chapter 40 notice, then it would apply. But what we're talking about is that the claimant didn't make a Chapter 40 notice. Someone else filed a complaint alleging class action. And so they're using not the statutory scheme for tolling, but the judicially created tolling associated with filing allegations of a class action. And what I was going to address with Justice Douglas, and this may be useful, is that the case of shooting, which this court's very familiar with, seem to indicate that these kind of soup to nuts, ground floor to roof allegations are not suitable for class action certification. And I think one of them...
But counsel, surely had the line in it that said, not all, it left, I'll use the term, wiggle room. And foreclosed everything.
I certainly agree with the court on that. My impression of the court's feeling on that was that there were areas where a single issue might be appropriate, and that single issue would be the reason behind a class certification. Our difficulty is that when we face allegations that start at the ground and go to the roof, there isn't a single issue that we're looking at. There are everything that Schutte, were condemned instead of throwing a class. We have no way to tell what was in the mind of a plaintiff's attorney about what they might have sought in the way of class certification. What we do have is a complaint, and the complaint says everything's wrong with these houses, everything's wrong with every house that's built in this project, and we want to toll the statute of repose until such time as either we get a lot of people together and sue, or the court, if we seek class certification, determines that there is a class.
But you could have brought a motion to challenge the class allegations.
We did. Well, we moved to dismiss and challenge class allegations, and at that time, Mr. Persiano...
You're not entirely at their mercy.
Well, may I continue?
Yes, of course.
Just so I'm clear, when you file a complaint, you don't serve it.
Yeah, fair enough.
You're at their mercy.
Yeah.
And when you amend it and you don't serve it, you're at their mercy. And when they did serve it, we filed our motion to dismiss within... they served it on us at 7:15. We filed our motion to dismiss at 8:04. So I respectfully wouldn't sit on our rights about that. And then Mr. Persiano, and I do respect him a lot, and I apologize for him and to the court about how aggressive we were in our opening brief, rightfully withdrew because probably live to fight another day would be a pretty good summary of it. He was going to lose that motion.
But if embedded in his class allegation complaint were one of the few Schutte class action appropriate claims, why would it not have told for the people who would have been protected by that class allegation to file their own 40 notice and try to bring another lawsuit. I mean, you're asking for prohibition and mandamus here.
Yes.
So it's an absolute cut and dried.
I'm asking that the court say that a judicially imposed or created tolling does not apply to the substantive rights given to us under the statute of repose.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Carlson, take 2 minutes now since we've gobbled up all your rebuttal time. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. What I was going to say is basically the issue that the court asked about, should the trial court consider the good faith of the allegations? And Mr. Carlson is a very good attorney. He knows the law very well. I'm sure he acted in good faith, but the result is that we held a complaint for the better part of a year, served on this, then drew the allegations concerning the class action. And it's hard to imagine that the court could not consider whether that is a, they were truly going to seek that for all of those claims. And that's a really difficult thing. But I'm a little concerned about the court having to analyze the good faith of all the claims. If there was, in fact, and of course you know some of the pipe cases that are running around right now, if there's an allegation about a single issue and they want to get it certified and they come before the court, as Rule 23 says, and as soon as practicable, then one can certainly say that that's brought in good faith. When it's filed and held and held and amended and held and held and then withdrawn, it's an inference that perhaps it's not being offered as purity that we would hope that claims are being made. I think this court needs to address this issue of first impression. I think the court should look closely to its sister state's Supreme Court. I believe Abano did a very good analysis. It's been some considerable time on that certified questions, and I would ask this court to have a bright mind that equitable tolling associated with the new filing of class action allegations does not play the statute of repose in the state of Nevada.
Justice
Douglas. You spoke of the Arizona case. Counsel spoke of it in terms of having the savings clause. Was that a correct application?
The savings clause that the Obama court dealt with at the end talked about the fact that it really didn't affect its decision. I think both sides at least agree that there is no similar savings clause here. The closest that Nevada has is that if a defect occurs in the final year, you get some extra additional time that allows you to come in later. That could be considered a savings clause. It doesn't really affect this analysis, at least in my humble opinion. And I don't believe that the Arizona Supreme Court felt it affected their analysis either, because looking at how they did their analysis, they waited until the very end. They'd already reached their conclusion as to the fact that this type of tolling doesn't apply. And they talked about it and said it really didn't change their opinion. So based upon that, I think that the savings clause doesn't really affect the analysis. And I would really urge the court to conclude.
Just say that.
The question is before a minute answer. Is the statutory scheme in Arizona the same as our Chapter 40?
Similar?
Thank you.
One more. Very good. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. We appreciate, again, the excellent arguments and briefs on this writ petition, and we will take this case under